James Callaghan becomes the Labour Prime Minister in 1976. Quite an unusual character in some ways. He was the son of an officer in the Navy, a low-level officer in the Navy, and he left school when he was 14 years old. Now, normally, if you want to be Prime Minister of Britain, you know, it's a better bet to go to Oxford or Cambridge and not leave school when you were 14 years old. So a surprisingly low social origin for a Prime Minister. When he was younger, he was in the army during World War II, like almost everybody was in the army, and he became a Labour Member of Parliament in the 1945 Clement Attlee governments, and later he will be Chancellor in the 1960s, Chancellor of the Exchequer then, Ministre des Finances, under the government of Harold Wilson. He then becomes Home Secretary, and he was one of the ministers, just one moment, he was one of the ministers who was involved in sending soldiers to Northern Ireland in 1969. I don't know, sometime in the 60s. Under the Wilson government, the government was 64 to 70, so sometime in this period. I don't have the dates right there. Now, when he was a minister in the 1960s, he was very much a defender of trade unions. He was one of these people who said, well, the trade unions founded the Labour Party, so a Labour government said, first of all, the first duty is to represent the trade unions. Yeah? Whereas other people in the Labour Party were saying, oh, no, especially if we want to win elections, we need to be a bit more distant from the trade unions. There's a big debate going on. When Harold Wilson resigned unexpectedly in 1976, Callaghan was elected then by the Labour members of Parliament to be the new leader, and therefore became the new Prime Minister. He was not a favourite. It was a bit of a surprise when he was not a favourite. He was 64 years old. Well, that's kind of old to be, you know, to suddenly become leader. However, he was the least divisive candidate. And we will see this happen again later on with other candidates. You have a party, this is the party in government, and you have kind of two wings, a sort of left and a sort of right. And it's not unusual that you find the situation where you cannot get consensus around the left-wing candidate, and you cannot get consensus about the right-wing candidate. And so a third person wins the election not because they have most people who are enthusiastic about them, but because they have the least people who do not want them to be in there. So it's this sort of the third horse phenomenon that he won the election for leader because there were no large numbers of people against him, whereas the other two candidates had this problem. Who were the other two candidates in 1976? Not sure. When he became Prime Minister, he was then in a difficult situation. The crisis has hit. It's 1976. The economic crisis has hit. And one of the results of this is a sterling crisis. That is a crisis of the currency. Callaghan goes to negotiate with the IMF. What's the IMF? The International Monetary Fund, that's right. En français, vous dites FMI, parce que vous faites tout à l'envers en France. Okay, the IMF, for a rescue passage, on dirait 2012, hein, il va chercher les FMI pour, pour de l'argent. Hein? This was very controversial because, just like today, the IMF said, okay, we'll lend you money, but we want you to reduce public expenditure. And we want you to limit wage rises. Yeah, so nothing. It sounds like 2012. It was 1976. Yeah, the IMF said, we'll lend you money, but there are conditions, like the situation in Greece today. Not so harsh, not so sharp. There was this led to a certain division between the Labour government and the Labour Party. Because the Labour government said, oh, well, we need to get this money from the IMF, so we need to reduce public spending. And the Labour Party said, but we are the party of the trade unions, we are the party of the working people. We don't want to reduce spending, social spending, that's not what we're for. And so the Labour Party conference voted not to reduce public spending. The conference, who is the conference? It's all the activists, all the individual members who in every town have meetings, political activists. But the Labour government does not have to follow the decisions of the party conference. And in fact, the power of the party conference has been reduced. For the last 30 years, the party conference has become less and less powerful. Okay, so we get into 1977, 1978. There are a series of strikes, especially in the public sector in 1978. And this is what we is often referred to in history books as the winter of discontent. L'hiver du mécontentement, littéralement. Because it was in winter and it was a lot of social unrest. Why the winter of discontent? In fact, this is a misquote from Shakespeare. Do you know which play? Richard III, the beginning of the play is, now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the son of York. Doesn't matter. And in fact, this has become, any time you have a winter where there are a lot of strikes, we talk about the winter of discontent, but that's not the meaning of the Shakespeare's quote. In fact, it's a misquote, so that's not so important. So, the winter of discontent, lot of strikes, nurses, dustbin men. You know, what do dustbin men do? They collect rubbish. You have these weedy bins, don't you? When you've opened your cornflakes and the cornflakes are empty, you throw them in the bin, and the bin goes into this big thing in front of your house, and every week or every 3 days, the dustbin men come to take it away. Interesting case, actually, because today, of course, they have these big plastic things with wheels, don't they? Can you see what I'm talking about? Big thing like that? Square? With wheels. But when I was young, they had metal ones with no wheels. They had to pick up the metal cans and carry them. It's very, very hard conditions. In any case, that was one of the reasons for the strikes, the dustbin men strikes. There were also strikes of local governments, employees, including the people who worked in the cemeteries. The conservative newspapers were very, very hard on the strikes. I remember one front page, they won't even let us bury our dead. On nous empêche même d'enterrer nos morts. Parce qu'il y avait les grèves des employés des cimetières. Yeah, so very, very, a very hard campaign against the strikers. And this was one of the reasons that the government lost popularity. They also had only one or two member majority in Parliament. And so in March 1979, by just one vote, the government lost a motion of no confidence in the Parliament. And so the Callaghan was obliged to resign and to call a general election. So that was the end of the third big Labour experiment. Well, the fourth, if you count Ramsay MacDonald. Since the Second World War, the first big Labour experiment, 1945, the second one, 1964, and the third one, 1974 to 1979, and that was the end of it. The reason I mention that is that from 1979, there will be 18 years of Conservative government. Yeah, 18 years, a big, long period. Yeah, where if you're a member of a political party, after 15 years, you're feeling pretty demoralised. It's all 15 years, well, let's wait. Before I go on to the 1980s, a couple more things about the 1970s. This is the time when North Sea oil comes on stream. In the very early 1970s, they discovered oil near Scotland, North Sea oil. a lot of it. And in fact, at this in this period, they said that Britain had as much oil as Iraq. Ça donne pas envie d'être le pays en question en voyant ce qui s'est passé en Irak. Mais, yeah, so this was an important discovery of oil near the North Sea, between Scotland and Norway. And this was very important for the public budget, because during the 70s and the 80s, and even today a little bit, there was a lot of money coming in for the oil, so the economic crisis was not quite as bad, because there was some money in there. One of the practical differences is that everybody in Britain began to use natural gas from the sea. Previously, before the 70s, the gas in your kitchen in England was fabricated from coal. It was made in a big factory from coal gas, and it's very dangerous as well. But in the 1970s, every house in the country, they came round and they changed your cooker so it could work on natural gas, which is gas from the North Sea. 1977 was a particular date at this time. 1977 was the Queen's Silver Jubilee. That is to say, it was the 25th anniversary of Queen Elizabeth as Queen. And this was amusing because in every school child was given a special book to commemorate the 25 years. And in many, many streets, ordinary people had a party. It was like an excuse for a party, a little bit like the wedding of Machan and Schmidlik the other year. Yeah. And it was a very popular event. I say that because it's important, because 1977, the Silver Jubilee, was a very popular event. But the 50th, the Golden Jubilee, 25 years later, nobody seemed to care much. So there is something happening to the attitude to the monarchy. I don't know exactly what it is. Of course, at the same time, this is also the time where really the public is nevertheless somewhat divided on this question, because the other big events of the Silver Jubilee of Elizabeth II was the release of a song by the Sex Pistols called God Save the Queen, which was not very polite about Madame the Queen. And the text is, God Save the Queen. Well, first of all, very sarcastic. God Save the Queen, we mean it, man, we love our Queen. Which is very interesting, because sarcastic rock songs were almost a new invention. Because rock was about partying, and you don't have a sarcastic party. Yeah. And so punk rock symbolised a new kind of rock that you could have, and this was also symbolised by this particular thing, God Save the Queen, a fascist regime, they made you a moron. Okay? And so, Dieu sauve la reine, c'est un régime fasciste, on a fait de vous un crétin. Bon, d'accord. Yeah. It's not very polite, but it's also very unusual for popular music. You know, popular music had been originally party music, and then poetic. It could be poetic, but sarcastic and aggressive. This was something new, and it was extremely popular. The song got to number two in the top 20, but it was never played on the BBC. Yeah. So there's some sort of tension around that. Okay, which takes us to the question of four nations, which I want to mention briefly. When I say four nations, of course, I'm talking about England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. I'm not sure if Northern Ireland is a nation or not, but we say four nations. Because something very new happened in the 1970s from this point of view. That is to say that the Labour Party decided to hold referendums in Scotland and in Wales concerning the establishment of an autonomous parliament. So I've probably said this before, we are not talking about independence. We are talking about an autonomous parliament. That is to say, a parliament who can make laws and make decisions for Scotland and for Wales, but are not allowed to talk about defence, taxation, the big questions, but can make laws about some aspects of education, health, transport, tourism, housing, etc. Now, the proposal for at the referendum was, do you want an autonomous parliament for Scotland? Do you want an autonomous parliament for Wales? And in both cases, if I remember correctly, in Wales, a big majority said no. In Wales, a big majority said, no, we don't want an autonomous parliament. Okay, so the nationalists were obviously not very happy, but that's life. And in Scotland, you got a situation where you had a small majority in favour of an autonomous parliament, but it was not enough to make the quorum. That is to say that the law about the referendum said you can have an autonomous parliament if 50% of voters and 40% of all the electorate say yes. Yeah, so there was a condition. Yeah? If too many people stay at home, it doesn't count. And so this was the case. So they got more than 50% of the people who voted, but quite a lot of people stayed at home, and the final result was not, the number of people voting for an autonomous parliament was not 40% of all the electorate. So after 1979, there was no autonomous parliament in Scotland and no autonomous parliament in Wales. We will come back to this because, in fact, that is the first bunch of referendums in 1979. But later, there were referendums again in Scotland and Wales. When? What year were the next lot of referendums? Anybody know this? In the 90s. Thank you. Good. Yes, 97. 97, yeah. So in 79 there were referendums, and in 97 there were referendums. Be careful. It's just the same thing with the two numbers turned around. And the result was radically different. Okay? You need to be reading some history books, I can see. Okay. Scottish, so obviously the Scottish nationalists and the Welsh nationalists were not so happy about losing the referendum, you know, because they had been for 40 years, 50 years, oh, well, one day we'll have a referendum. Okay, it's not a referendum for independence. No, that would be better, but it's a referendum for an autonomous parliament. It's a great step forward for Scotland, thought the Scottish nationalist, if you remember me or Hoyle. But no. So demoralisation for the Scottish nationalists and the Welsh nationalists. Two things to say about Scottish and Welsh nationalism. The first thing is you mustn't forget that 85% of the population of the United Kingdom lives in England. So everything we say about Scotland and Wales is important, but we're talking about 10% of the population. Wales has between 1.5 and 2 million people. Yeah, and Scotland has somewhat more. I'm not quite sure how many, but you know, a few million. And England has 40 million or something, yeah? So although I don't mean that they're not important. They are important, but you must remember that four nations is not four quarters of the United Kingdom. The other thing is that Scottish nationalism and Welsh nationalism are radically different. Scottish nationalism is fundamentally political, quite a lot of support for independence. I saw this week a newspaper article, 37% of people in Scotland would like independence. This is the highest for many, many decades. We've never seen that. We're amazed. 37% want independence, not autonomy, independence of Scotland. They probably won't get it, but they might, which would be interesting. In Wales, however, a very, very small number of people want independence. And in general, the nationalism in Scotland is more political, because they already have political specificities. The education system in Scotland is different. The legal system in Scotland is different. The religion in Scotland is different from Wales. From England. Whereas Wales has the same education system, the same legal system, etc. The fundamental reason is that many centuries ago, Wales was conquered by military force in the 14th century. And so, you know, they just got the same political system. There was no negotiation. They just got what the English gave them. However, Scotland was united with England according to the Union of 1707, which was a negotiation between the Scottish elite and the English elite, and the English elite had to make a lot of concessions. Okay, you can have your own legal system, no problem. Okay, we won't impose the Church of England. Okay, you can have your own education system. So it's a completely different kind of union up there and down there. Wales, Scotland. Oh, sorry. Okay, from your point of view. Welsh nationalism is much less political and much more based around the language. Because in Scotland, 2% of the population speak Gaelic. And in Wales, 20%. So not at all the same situation. What's more, in Wales, they did a survey recently, 5 years ago, and if you look at children between 5 years old and 15 years old, 40% can speak Welsh in Wales. Yeah. So the situation is looking stable. Welsh is not in danger. The number of people speaking Welsh is rising, slowly. Whereas Scottish, 2% of the population, mostly old people, it's not looking good. It's difficult to defend minority languages because, young people and young adults, even in Wales, you know, they go to the cinema, everything's in English, they put on the television, almost everything's in English. You know, they have to work to keep their Welsh. So, in any case, Scottish nationalism, more political, especially now there is oil near Scotland, money in it, and Welsh, much more cultural, and in particular the defence of the Welsh language, which has been carried out with a certain success. Today in Wales, I will come back to this question, but today in Wales, Welsh and English have equal status. If you write a letter to the tax office in Welsh, they are obliged by law to answer you in Welsh. They are not allowed to answer you in English. So quite strong legal protection for a language. If I wanted a job at a university in Wales teaching history, which I would teach in English, probably I would have to show either, one, I spoke Welsh, or two, I was learning Welsh and I was moving to Wales with the intention of learning Welsh. It's quite a strong, protection for the Welsh language. Question? No, you're just thinking, that's good. Okay, so important questions to four nations, I think it's very important, especially in France, because I noticed in France, French people adore Scotland, and they adore Ireland, and I suspect it's because there are no English people there. I think that's the main reason, you know. But certainly Scotland and Ireland have a great presence abroad, especially Ireland. I mean, you've got all the Irish pubs. There are far more Irish pubs in Paris than there are English pubs, which is a little strange idea, really, isn't it? Apparently, the Irish pubs in Berlin are more Irish than the Irish pub in Dublin, I've been told, yeah, because identity is a funny thing. Okay, so I'll come back to the four nations. Let's go then to the election of Margaret Thatcher. 1979, the election of Margaret Thatcher. Returned with a majority of 43. You see, here you have the timeline. I'm not going to go through it in detail, but I think it will be very useful to you to put everything back into this. This is almost like a plan. She's elected with a majority of 43, that is to say she had 43 more members of parliament than 50% of the parliament. So, not a massive majority, a reasonable majority, because the Labour Party had a majority of 3 or 4, so a reasonable majority, but not a massive majority. Also, of course, she is specific in that she is the first British woman, the first woman Prime Minister in Britain. Who was the first woman Prime Minister in France? Thank you. J'ai vu que est-ce qu'il y a quelqu'un qui avait oublié qui était la première Premier ministre femme en France? Parce qu'elle est devenue assez oubliable quand même. C'est vrai que c'est. On parle pas du cressonisme quand on parle du thatcherisme. Yeah? She did not manage to make a real mark. And certainly, whatever one thinks about Margaret Thatcher, she was successful in making a mark. People will not forget me, and that certainly was the case. Although she was a lady, she certainly was not a feminist. Her government had fewer women ministers than any government for a long time, and for any government afterwards. Yeah, she was very, very strictly surrounded herself with men. She worked very hard on her image. What kind of adjectives do you think of? What kind of image did she have, Margaret Thatcher, or do you have of Margaret Thatcher? Oh, yeah, the Iron Lady. So what kind of personality does that mean? Say again? Very strong, determined, uncompromising, no compromises. This is the image. I'm not talking about the reality. We'll look at the reality in a moment. Anything else about her image? What about how she dressed and so on? Yeah, yes. Yeah, could you put that into words? Yeah, she has this grimace on her, yes? Sort of gloomy dressing, okay?
She was not really crazy the way she dressed. I think, I when I imagine it, I think in grey or blue or...
Yeah, a sort of old country auntie. Yeah, yeah, that's the sort of thing, yeah? Yeah, not modern and relaxed. Yeah, not modern, not relaxed, that's for sure, yeah? Very, very interesting case, because in fact, if you look at photographs of Margaret Thatcher before she was Prime Minister, it's more modern and more relaxed. The official image of the, you know, old-fashioned, extremely serious and stern was invented. It was, and her voice also, she had voice training to you know, when you're going to be Prime Minister, image is very important, huh? You see with poor old François Hollande, I'm not talking about his politics, but certainly you could see that he has lost a lot of weight. He has lost a lot of weight. And politically, that is important. You know, when you're François Hollande's age, I know something about this, it's very easy to gain weight. Yeah, it's very easy to gain, you know, 3 kilos every year, but after 10 years, that's 30 kilos, you know. But it's not an accident that François Hollande has lost weight. It's a political image question. It's if he was 20 kilograms heavier, that would be a political problem. Because image is... Of course, there are many people who vote according to the ideas, but there is a section who are very influenced by the image, and they're important people. So it's certainly true. That was just an example. But certainly, Thatcher worked very hard on the image. The other thing of her image was... I'm just an ordinary housewife. And she very often said, you know, I know that housewives around the country understand me. You must not spend more money than you have. I know this because I'm a housewife and you're a housewife. Vote for me. Yeah. So this is one form of what we often call populism. Now, what is populism? You have to be very precise about what populism is. It's not just an insult, you know. On the facimos, I'm populist, but what does that mean exactly? Well, in this particular form, it means support me because I'm an ordinary person. This is very, very common in the United States. This is, and it's coming over to Europe as well. You know, why do they film presidents jogging? I mean, are you really going to vote for somebody because they jog? So it's all about, you know, we're just ordinary people. Much stronger than the United States, lots of film of Barack Obama playing with his children. Yeah, and again, you know, when you're thinking about who should be president, I'm not saying, oh, I hope he plays with his children well. But it's all about image, yeah? And so this is a form of populism, and Margaret Thatcher was very strong on that. I'm just an ordinary person. I don't like experts. We don't need experts. What we need is common sense. Now, this was a complete image. It was absolutely not true. When she went on holiday, she went on holiday with economics professors to give her economics classes. No, really. Because the idea that in a modern country, the idea that you can be a prime minister without experts is completely ridiculous. All prime ministers need lots of experts every day. That's not, if you were prime minister, you would need lots of experts. Because you can't know everything. But the image is, oh, well, experts, no, I'm my own woman and I decide and so on. So important differences in image. Important differences in philosophy. I don't know if you've heard of this gentleman. Does anybody have an idea who this is?
An economist.
Oh, an economist, yeah, yep. I think it's early 20th, but I wouldn't swear on it. Yeah. He's also part of a philosophical movement of what is known as methodological individualism. This is a philosophy. Methodological individualism is a philosophy. And what it says is you can understand society by studying individuals. What matters is individuals. This is individualism in the philosophical sense. I don't mean that she only thought about herself. But the problem is not social classes. The problem is not, in the opinion of this gentleman, the problem is not ethnic groups or social classes or men and women. And the problem is, look, what do individuals do to choose? And so it's all about choice. Yeah, so what you have to do, it's a very conservative philosopher, you need to maximise the amount of choice in society. And therefore, the idea is that the best way to organise everything is like a private company. Private companies are the best way to organise human activity. And so what we need to do with the public sector is make it resemble a private company. Now, this is not always just privatisation. There is a lot of privatisation. But it's even when something remains public. For example, if you take emergency hospitals. If you know the hospitals where you go if it's an emergency. It is, in a modern society, it is impossible to privatise these. Because it would be politically impossible to literally say to somebody, oh, you're dying, where's your money? It would be politically impossible. But even though it cannot be privatised, the ideas of Thatcherism would say you need to make it work in the same way as a private company. You need hierarchical management. You need careful accounting and so on. I will come back to this question. It's quite difficult. But let's say that Thatcher represents then, in my opinion, the Toryism of the crisis. That is to say, in the 50s and the 60s, there was quite a lot of influence for one-nation Toryism. One-nation Toryism, the idea, we are conservatives, but we are interested in reducing tension between social groups. We are interested in eliminating the worst inequalities. Remember, in the 50s, the conservative government built 300,000 social houses a year. This is the Toryism of the boom. And the Toryism of the crisis is, OK, let's go back to direct class struggle. The aim is not to have a good relationship with trade unions. It is to defeat trade unions. The aim is not to build lots of houses. It is to reduce public spending as much as possible. We often say neoliberalism for this idea. But it's because of the crisis that now it is more difficult for companies to make profits. And therefore, it's very important for companies and for conservative governments in particular to reduce taxes for companies. And if you reduce taxes, then you reduce public spending. And so this is the new idea. But it goes with a philosophy. And in fact, the extreme of this philosophy is when Margaret Thatcher is interviewed and somebody asks her a question about crime and the social reasons for crime. And do you remember what she says? She says, there is no such thing as society. On a traduit en français, ce qu'on appelle la société, ça n'existe pas. A very, very strong idea. And the full quote is, there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals and families. Now, of course, this is a philosophical statement, so it doesn't mean she applies that every day because it becomes impossible. But that means, for example, if you look at crime, there are many ways of looking at crime. But Margaret Thatcher says you don't need to study how young people are treated at school, what kind of houses they live in. That doesn't matter. They are criminals because they chose to be criminals. Point la ligne. That's the end of the story. So this is the idea of methodological individualism, that people are poor because they choose to be poor, unemployed because they choose to be unemployed, etc. So there's a very, very hard... Now, this is the philosophical statement. Often it is not applied in every detail because it is politically impossible. But it's to move into that direction. I will give you many examples of this because it's quite complicated. So let's look at then Thatcher and the welfare states. Basically, what Thatcher does is she opens up 20, 30 different battles to reduce public spending and to reform the welfare state. Very often she will say, I am modernising the welfare state. We always have to be very careful with the word modernise, because, of course, no government ever says, I am doing this reform because I want to make the welfare state more old-fashioned. It's impossible to say. It's impossible for politicians to say, I am against being modern. Modern is a positive word, a universal positive word, so all governments are obliged to say, I am modernising. But, you know, we need to be careful how we look at this. It doesn't have a lot of meaning, modernising. Of course, it has a lot of meaning if you're talking about your iPhone, but if you're talking about the health system, what is modernising the health system? When you're not, apart from the technology, it's an ideological word. So what she will do is she will open up 10, 20, 30 different struggles at the same time in order to reduce public spending, to make the trade unions weaker, to persuade people that private industry is better than the public sector, and of course to persuade people to vote Conservative. Now, we have no reason to believe that she was not sincere in her political engagements. It doesn't seem to me to be very useful to assume that politicians are cynical and don't have any values. I think she did that because she believed that a private industry was the best. I'm sure that you're not surprised when I say that these are not my ideas. I don't keep my ideas secret. But nevertheless, I think we need to analyse what are Thatcher's ideas, and you must avoid saying, oh, well, you know, she loved the rich and she hated the poor, so she did this. That's not our job. When you're a historian, that's not our job to say, you know, oh, well, she was a bastard. Well, yeah, that's not a historian's job. Right, so what are these battlefields? Number one, privatisation. What can be privatised? You remember that the big nationalisations happened in 1945 and 1950. Coal, transports, telephones, television, railway. Margaret Thatcher will slowly privatise many of these. Why slowly? There's a problem. When you are a democratically elected government, you can make the people unhappy a bit, but you mustn't go too far. Yeah? You've got to pull some of public opinion along with you, or there's only 5 years between elections. Yeah? If you do your entire programme immediately and you make lots of people unhappy, then you lose the next election. So yes, that's good. So all of the different programmes that she had went slowly. And very often the number of laws. I will be talking about this later on. But in the other two pieces of paper I have given you, you have a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 laws about trade unions in the Conservative governments from 1979 to 1993. 7 laws about trade unions. That's massive. Is this because they changed their minds 7 times? That's a bit worrying, isn't it? Not at all. It's because you must go slowly or you go too far, especially with the trade unions, because the Labour government of the 1960s, with In Place of Strife, had to abandon their plans for trade unions. The Conservative government in 1971 with the Industrial Relations Act had to abandon their plans with trade unions. In 1972 with Saltley and the Pentonville Five, the government was completely defeated by the trade unions. So when Margaret Thatcher wants to attack the trade unions, she does it in 7 steps. Well, Thatcher and the Conservatives, because the last law is under Major. Yeah. So do it slowly, take it bit by bit. Yeah. So privatisation. The development of business values. I will come back to that. Changes in tax policy. One of the most important changes is a rise in indirect taxation and a reduction in direct taxation. Direct taxation is taxation on your income. I earn £20,000, I pay so much. You earn £2,000, you pay so much. Direct taxation is taxation on your income. Yeah? As when the money arrives to your house, some of it doesn't arrive to your house. Yeah. Margaret Thatcher reduced massively the tax for higher incomes. I think that the highest level of tax for higher incomes was 92% or something, and it went down to 60 or 65%. It went down a lot. This is according to the conservative theory that if you allow rich people to earn more money, then the economy will get better and everybody will benefit from it. A very, very classic conservative theory. But you still need a lot of money when you're the government. And so a rise in indirect taxation. Indirect taxation is tax which you pay when you buy things. Yeah, if you buy a watch like this one, which I got free, in fact, from Jules. But if I had bought it, then I would pay, 17% VAT in France? 19.6? Yeah, 19.6, okay. That's indirect taxation. Now, from a social point of view, they're very different, because if a rich person buys the watch, they pay exactly the same tax as a poor person who buys the watch. So direct taxation on income, in the 20th century, has been a big influence for reducing inequality. Whereas indirect a massive move towards indirect taxation is based on the idea that tax is bad, and in particular, taxing rich people is bad because you damage the economy in this way. For a long time in the Labour Party, in the 50s and 60s, you had the idea tax is good, because tax is hospitals, railways, and other things like that. Yeah, I think today we do still. And certainly in France, there's a big tradition that tax is bad. Yeah, I know that in France, among middle-class people, if people don't pay their tax, they're very proud of it. They tell all their friends, "Oh, I didn't pay my tax," you know. Whereas in England, if people don't pay their tax, they keep quiet. You know, they're a little bit ashamed. Yeah, it's very French. You know, it's like the speed cameras. The speed cameras where you get caught on the motorways going too fast and you have to pay a fine. I'm always getting emails from my friends saying, "Here is a map of the speed cameras. You know, avoid getting fined." And I just send a message back saying, "Slow down, relax. It's not. You don't need to go so fast." Okay, so back to Thatcher and the welfare state. It was difficult to reduce public spending. The wonderful thing about the 1950s and 1960s, the post-war boom, is that people had better health. The children were getting better food. Working conditions were not so dangerous. There were still lots of problems. Housing was better. The lead-based paints. There was no more, the government regulations for paints and for conditions were better, and so people were living longer. And the problem with people living longer is it costs a lot of money. When people are 70 or 80 years old, they need more doctors, because they have more health problems. Because it will happen to you too, sooner than you think. Okay, and secondly, because unemployment had risen and was very high, again, that's very expensive. And so you got Thatcher, who had decided it was necessary to cut public spending, but it's not so easy. Because it's, again, it is politically possible to reduce the money which unemployed people receive, but it is politically impossible to stop giving money to unemployed people. It's not possible to just let people, not politically possible, to just let people starve on the streets. Okay, so privatization, British Gas and British Telecom were sold off. And they were sold off in a particular way. So British Gas was the nationalised industry which had the monopoly on gas. My father worked for British Gas. British Telecom was the nationalised telephone company. There were no private telephone companies. They had monopoly, nationalised monopoly. And these were privatised, that is that they were sold, the government sold them to shareholders. And they did it in a particular way. They tried very hard to sell small numbers of shares to large numbers of people. So when it was time for British Gas to be privatised, they had a big advertising campaign. Buy your shares in British Gas, maximum of 10 per person, something like that. So this was very important, not from an economic point of view. In fact, from an economic point of view, it's not very easy. It's much easier to have three big companies who own British Gas rather than 100,000 small owners. But it was a political aim. The idea of the advertising campaign was to show the opinion of the government about the future of society. What we need, said Thatcher, she didn't say it exactly, but what we need is a society where everybody is a little capitalist. Yeah? Everybody has some shares. And because we are the government and we believe in this, we are going to sell British Gas, maximum 10 shares to each individual, so everybody can have some share in the nationalised company. So what you have here is two different arguments. You have a political argument where some people say, well, a nationalised monopoly is a good thing because then you have, it's a public service. You guarantee that people in small villages get gas, even though it's much more expensive to take gas to small villages. And we mustn't sell it because it belongs to the whole people. And if we sell it, then it will belong to private individuals. And that's not fair. We believe in public service, so we must not privatise it. And on the other hand, you have the people who say, no, we must privatise it because private businesses are much more efficient than the public sector. People work harder. The managers can manage and give a better salary to encourage people or find people who will work for less. Private companies are a better way to organise a service, and therefore the customers will have a better deal. This is the economic argument. And then you have the political argument. We mustn't privatise because it belongs to the people and public service. And this very intelligent thing is, we are being generous and forward-looking and dynamic by selling British Gas to individuals because we are giving power to people. Yeah? We don't want the old nationalised bureaucracy. Now, bureaucracy, yeah, caca, okay? The new system is everybody will have a little bit, okay? Yeah, now, it's very important to understand how this works. Now, when you're writing about it, for me or for the CAPES or whatever, it's not important if you agree with Thatcher or not. That's not important at all. It doesn't matter. You just must understand how it works, yeah? You don't lose any marks for thinking Thatcher's wonderful. I don't care, okay? Right, so that's Thatcher and the welfare state. Privatisation, first of all. Then secondly, British Rail was privatised. I'm now talking about the whole of the Conservative governments, including John Major, who came afterwards. What were the results of the privatisation? Well, it's not easy to say. People on the left who were opposed to the privatisations always used the example of British Rail, because the privatisation of British Rail was a disaster. And for a period, when you got on a British train, you were not sure if you were going to get to your destination or not. It was just an absolute disaster. I mean, British trains became the joke of Europe. However, it is a little unfair on Margaret Thatcher to consider that British Rail was a typical privatisation. Yeah, it's un peu trop facile. Because if you take a situation like British Telecom, so the telephones were privatised, it's not obvious that the service was worse. It's not so clear. So I although it would be very tempting, as somebody who doesn't agree with Thatcher, it's very tempting to concentrate on the big disaster, which was British Rail. And today, you can't find, it's very difficult to find a Conservative who doesn't think that the privatisation of British Rail was a disaster. I remember getting on a train in Leeds to go to Manchester. It was 5 o'clock in the evening, and there were 1,000 people who wanted to get on the train, and it was a train with 200 seats. And so the rest of them waited another hour for the next one. It was absolutely stunningly bad. And at the moment, there's a new scandal about the privatised railways now, where the government... Because the government, although they are privatised, the government has to help if it goes very bad. So it's so there you go for British Rail. But not so obvious for British Telecom, British Gas. Is it much better? Is it much worse? Not easy to say from the point of view of the customer. From the point of view of the trade unions, privatisation was definitely worse. It was much harder to organise trade unions in private companies. The traditional working conditions of the nationalised industries were not respected. If you want to see a film about the privatised railways in Britain, there's a film called The Navigators by Ken Loach. Je crois que même il a mis sur YouTube maintenant. Alors, Ken Loach, c'est quelqu'un qui déteste Margaret Thatcher. Alors, vous savez à quoi vous savez à quoi vous devez vous attendre. Right, now, let's have a look at housing. Because remember when I was talking about the 1950s, I said that the welfare state is very complicated. There's nationalisation, there's housing, there's health, there's education, there's regulation, town planning, transport. It's an enormous thing, unemployment benefits. The welfare state is a massive thing. And so the modernisation of the welfare state, according to Thatcher, or the attack on the welfare state, according to the Labour Party, was also very complicated. And housing was one of the areas. You'll remember that in the 50s and 60s, millions of council houses were built. Social housing, fairly low rent, quite often with a little garden, which was a great step forward for most people. Some of it was a disaster. Yeah, the high-rise tower blocks, not so good. So what could Thatcher do with these council houses? Millions of council houses. Now, Thatcher and the Thatcherites believe that this is not great. It's better, I'm talking as Margaret Thatcher now, it's better if people own their own house. Why is it better? Well, we think that people will be more conservative if they own their own houses, if they have property. Yeah. That's the idea. Yeah. So what can we do to reduce the number of people paying low rent? Millions and millions of people, huh? Paying low rent in council houses. Even today, there are still millions of council houses. There were more before. What can we do? Well, I know what we'll do. We will encourage people to buy their council house. So you live in a council house, you're poor, okay? You don't mind? Okay, you live in a council house, and you've been living there for 10 years or 20 years because, you know, you won't find anywhere cheaper. And what the government is going to do is they're going to make a special deal, a special cheap price, and you can buy your council house. Oh, okay, it will take you 15 years to pay for it, but, you know, it's not much more expensive than the rent. And so they will declare that they will pass a law saying, 1980, a law saying that councils, the local government, must give the possibility to their council tenants to buy the house they are in. Now, this is a political question. The Conservatives say, Thatcher says, this is an act of liberty. We are freeing people. Before, they had to pay rent to the council bureaucracies, and now they are free, and we are giving you the right to own your house, to be a more independent person. So this is the future, this is progressive. And the opposition have a different political view. So, there's a problem. This is the opposition now. There's a problem. Supposing in London we have a million council houses. I'm making up the figures. If we sell half of them to the people who live in them, then we only have half a million. So all the young adults who are looking for their first house, we have no houses for them anymore. You see, in the old system, before 1980, you live in a council house, and supposing you get a better job, and you have a bit more money, and you would like to be an owner of a house, well, then in that case, you buy a house somewhere else, and you leave this council house empty for somebody who needs it. So this, from the point of view of the Labour Party, is a public service and should be maintained, and so selling council houses is a bad thing, because we are making life harder for the future poor people who need council housing. So it's a political, it's politics, it's not about management or technicality, it's a political thing. That if you believe, like Thatcher did, that house owners are more responsible, more independent, will be better for society, and will make people less dependent, then you could say that giving people the right to buy their council house is a step forward. Whereas if you think that council housing is a public service, then you probably think it's a step backward. It has to be said, though, that I think from a political point of view, from a technical political point of view, it was very intelligent. See, it's not "we are selling the council houses." That was not the slogan. The slogan was "we are giving people the right to buy their own home." So the political slogan was genius, really. Very, very clever. Very, very clever. So it's presented in this particular way. So in this case, just like in other cases, we see that how Thatcher presents her policies is extremely important. And it will be relatively successful because she is elected first in 1979. In 1983, she is elected again. And in 1987, she is elected again. Not with a massive majority, but nevertheless, it is successful. It worked pretty well. She also had an accidental boost in 1982 when she was not so strong in 1982 before the election in 1983. And suddenly the government of Argentina decided to occupy the Falkland Islands, Les Îles Malouines, which was wonderful for Margaret Thatcher. So there was a war between Britain and Argentina. Argentina had no chance. The British Army is, I think, number 10 in the world, and Argentina is number 154. It was a joke. It was a massacre. It wasn't a war. But it was very, very good for Margaret Thatcher's election chances. I will come back to that. Local government and the health service. So still back with the welfare state here. 2:10. Yes, it's okay. At 2:30, we'll stop. So we only have one. Person here, don't we? We have Audrey. We don't have Stephanie, do we? Nope. Okay. So we just have one. So I'll stop at 2:30, and we'll move on to Audrey. Local government and the health service. So you have a lot of hospitals, a lot of clinics, a lot of local housing departments, street cleaning. All of these are organised by local governments. Traffic lights, road repair. And this is all public sector work. And Margaret Thatcher's thinking, how can I make the private sector more involved in health and more involved in local government? Very difficult. Remember that health is free. And it's politically impossible to change this. It's just suicide. So how can we get the private sector involved otherwise? Well, what they did is move towards a delegation of public service to private companies. I will explain. You have a hospital, has 1,000 employees or 2,000 employees. The hospitals are big. Have a look at it, and let's see, perhaps some of the services could be done with public money by private companies. So, for example, simple example, the canteen, the hospital canteen, the food. It had always been public, you know, the hospital employees did it. No, 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 no. and the government passes a law to says if you are a hospital, every 5 years you must put out a tender, an appel d'offres, and find if there is a private company who can do it cheaper. And so what you have then is the privatisation of the hospital canteens. Now, it is a partial privatisation because the canteens are paid for with public money, but the private companies give the do the work. Afterwards, it just takes a little bit of imagination. How about X-rays, la radiologie? I'm sure it's possible to find private companies who will do the X-rays for you. And so every 5 years, every hospital must look around to the private companies and say, OK, who can do it cheaper? Yeah, we need 20,000 X-rays every year. Yeah, how much do you want to do that? Ah, he's cheaper. Yeah. So the privatisation of the radiology, of the technical side, not the medical side. That was one very important method. It's called compulsory competitive tendering. Compulsory competitive tendering. Tendering, c'est le verbe to tender, c'est émettre un appel d'offre. Si vous, je sais que vous êtes, vous travaillez peut-être pas dans les entreprises. So, compulsory, obligatoire. Donc, émission obligatoire d'appel d'offre compétitif. Non, pas compétitif, concurrentiel. Yeah, okay. It's very, very, again, very interesting idea. Why do this? One, the trade unions in the privatised hospital canteen and in the privatised X-ray department will not be so powerful. Two, it might be cheaper for the hospital. Three, it's reducing the presence in national life of the public sector. And so it is supporting this long campaign to persuade people that private companies are the best way to organise economic activity. Now, they were obliged to be a little careful, because what about the people who already work in the canteen? Well, there are two options here. First of all, quite often you've got something rather unusual, where you go to the hospital in January, and you say hello to the people in the canteen. You say, oh, hello. Then you go again 6 months later and the canteen has been privatised, but it's the same person in a different uniform. Yeah, because they just they didn't have a job, and the new company who arrived simply employed the same people. Yeah. Sometimes they were obliged to employ the same people. If the hospital trade unions were strong, they would oblige the hospital to guarantee a stability of employment, but normally they could not guarantee the same wages and the same working conditions and so on.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What is the change in for customers?
First of all, the word customers is the word that Thatcher would certainly use, whereas the rest of the world would say patients. What is the change for customers? Often not very big. Often a not very big change. Sometimes the private company was very bad, but not always. It's a bigger change for the workers in the canteen. Yeah. In general, conditions were not so good. And trade unions were not so present. But in general, that is part of the idea, actually, because one of the aims of Thatcherism was to encourage everybody to consider themselves as customers all day. Even the vocabulary, yeah, in the train stations, they used to say, "Passengers for Manchester, please take the train at platform 5." And then they started saying, "Customers for Manchester." Not passengers, but customers. Yeah, it's a very, very important ideological filter. What else could they do? Well, they wanted to reorganize the central administration, what you would call in French then the fonction publique d'État. So the fonction publique d'État do a lot of useful work. You know, they collect the taxes, they administer the health and the sports and administration, yeah, all the ministères around Paris or around London, the central administrations. What can be done here to reduce spending, make the trade unions weaker, involve the private sector more, etc.? In general, it was pretty difficult to privatise. For example, one of the big agencies organises passports. L'impression et l'administration des passeports. It's not easy to sell this to McDonald's. Yeah. A little dangerous, even. Yeah. I'm being a little flippant. So what did they, what they tried to do was to imitate private sector methods inside the public administrations. So impossible to privatize. A lot of things are impossible to privatize. I think passports is an example. You can't privatize the passports because it's a security problem, for a start. So what did they do? First of all, they tried to reduce the number of staff. So make it cheaper by having less staff. Secondly, they tried to separate the central administrations into smaller units. So the passports were part of the Home Office, the Ministre de l'Intérieur, a big, big thing. And they separated it off passports, became an agency, and secteur autonome de la fonction publique. And so they separated them out, a little bit like in the metro in Paris. For a long time, there was people worked for the RATP. And now each line is kind of separate. Yeah? And that's important. Why? Well, the trade unions are weaker in that way. They stopped national pay negotiations. Before Margaret Thatcher, in the La Fonction Publique, the civil service, every year there would be a national pay negotiation, like in France today, la grille salariale nationale de la fonction publique. Tout le monde a une augmentation ou personne. One person. They stopped that completely. So pay must be negotiated locally in every section separately. Thirdly, they increased different salaries. So before Margaret Thatcher, if you worked in the passport office, well, you had this was your wage. And after 5 years, you had a higher wage. And after 10 years, you had a higher wage. That was the old method. They abolished that. They have the new method, which is every year you get a mark, how good is your work, and you get more money because your work was better than his work. Yeah? So individualization of salaries. Now, these were the general objectives. The unions were not happy. And very often these objections were applied very slowly. Because in one sector, so for example, the individualization of salaries, which we also call merit pay, le salaire au mérite. In one section, the Ministry of Defense, for example, for the civilians, there was no resistance, and so it was established. In another section, the passports, the trade unions went on strike for one day and then 2 days, and they had to negotiate, and so They only introduced a part of it, and then 2 years later, a little more, etc. So this was the general objections and the general trend, but it took a long time, and some of the things they never managed to do. The merit pay was with annual reports on every individual. In some sectors, it was impossible to do; there was too much resistance. But these are the general sort of methods. Yeah. So generalisation also of annual reports, la notation annuelle des salariés individuels. We have a similar situation in France with university teachers. Yeah. That a few years ago, there was a proposal that the president of the university should decide which teachers should be paid differently. You don't remember, we were on strike for 4 months. Il y avait un semestre qu'il n'y avait pas, il y a 4 ans. And the plan was abandoned. But they will probably come back with it again later on, but you know, it was abandoned. Okay, let's have a little look at the National Health Service. National Health Service. And the internal market. So again, it's the same priority every time. When Margaret Thatcher's government looked at the National Health Service, said, what can we do to encourage business values and to reduce spending and to reduce the power of trade unions and so on? And their big idea here was the internal market. And the internal market is like, is a way of imitating the functioning of a private company. So before Thatcher, the doctor phoned the hospital and said, I have three people here who need an appendix operation. And the hospital said, oh, okay, ooh, you'll have to wait 2 weeks if it's not urgent because we don't have enough beds. And the new method, the doctor had to phone three hospitals, said, how much is the cost for an operation? Now, there was no real money involved. It was imaginary money. That is that the doctor was told they should only spend £100,000 a year of imaginary money. It's imaginary money, yeah? So they phone the hospital, and the hospital says, oh, well, we have a lot of people who want operations right now. I could do you an appendix operation, but it will cost £1,000. And so, okay, I'm sorry. I thought the numbers were, oh, yeah, oh, we had two people cancelled this week, so we can do you an operation for only £500. So what you got was an imaginary money system. This is the internal market. It's an imaginary money system which obliges people to know exactly how much everything costs and obliges the hospitals. Why? Well, the main aim is to be able to control very precisely the budget. And so this allows a manager to come in and say, okay, in Leeds, the average cost of an operation is only £600. Why is it more expensive here? Ah, I can see you have too many receptionists, or whatever. Yeah, it allows private-style management to be imposed on public things. What was the effect? Again, difficult to say. Certainly, for a few years, things got worse. Waiting lists became very long. Est-ce que vous avez entendu la réputation de l'Angleterre des longues listes d'attente? Il faut dire, pour être juste, c'est une réputation qui était beaucoup plus justifiée en 85 ou en 95 qu'aujourd'hui. Ça a beaucoup changé, mais la réputation, ça prend plus de temps. It could be quite a big scandal. The other scandal is sometimes the numbers are quite... They had a lot of performance indicators. For example, they said, when you arrive in the hospital... a doctor will see you within 30 minutes. Okay, that was yeah. And if there is a hospital which is not succeeding in seeing doctors on average within 30 minutes, then they sack the manager and they get a new manager. You know. But then you get all sorts of bizarre things where the hospital will phone the ambulance and say, we don't have a doctor ready. Can you drive really slowly, please? Now, I'm not joking. This is real cases, yeah? So it can have effects. I'm not talking about emergencies, okay? I'm not talking about people dying in general. But it can have rather bizarre effects because you've got people ticking boxes and of course, people are normally more intelligent than the system. And so they can sort of find ways around it. Just like... students find ways round marking systems. You know, I'm not going to give you any. I know more than you do, so I'll not give you any. Okay, listen, that's good. I've got a good start there, and I will continue that next week. But we're going to now have a guest appearance from Star Audrey here, who's going to talk to us about... I'm going to read it first. Which...